silence. Extinction reduces biodiversity, but it also means some being will never be able to tell us how it experiences the world. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The author of Into Great Silence is our guest, and our number is statewide 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at alaskapublic.org. Extinction caused by us has already happened, and it will happen more. And it's today's subject on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
The Kinnick Arm Crossing would connect Anchorage to the Matsu Valley. The bridge is intended to create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and save freight costs for Alaska's interior and North Slope. More information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Growing up in the highlands of Pennsylvania, of course, like any kid, even back in the 50s, we learned about certain extinctions that had taken place. For instance, the passenger pigeon died out. Used to darken the skies at times, they said. It wasn't until many years later that I went back to the Historical Society in Potter County, Pennsylvania, in the highlands there, and saw the pictures of the nets that they had used on the hills right above my hometown to capture those passenger pigeons. And somehow, it then touched me. Extinction. I don't think we want to look at it. I think it's very hard for us to contemplate it. And we look away given the slightest opportunity. So maybe you will tune your radio away in no time as we discuss it with somebody who's looked very deeply at it. Eva Salidis, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks so much, Steve.
So it turns out you're from that area too, up there and outside of Erie, Pennsylvania.
Right, just south of Buffalo.
And,
I had a similar story about extinction. It's the way I start my book, actually. My first perception of extinction was with an awareness of the Eskimo Curlew story from a ABC after-school special called The Last of the Curlews, which was actually based on a book. I didn't realize that at the time, but it's actually a beautiful animated film. And that was I was probably about 7 years old, and that was my first inkling that extinction was a reality, that the human beings could actually wipe a species out from the earth. And it was a kind of a seminal moment for me, but I didn't realize the significance of it until I was writing this book.
Well, you and I both experienced the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989. And I was in touch with your partner, your research partner, Craig Mackin, at that time. And as the years rolled on afterwards, he was telling me about these two different types of killer whales, the orcas. One was the residents, they ate fish, and the other was the transients, and they ate marine mammals. And then he told me that one of those populations was severely impacted. And that's what your book is about, transient orcas. But it didn't sink in when he told me what it really meant, that we have a population that looks like it's going to go extinct because this was just too much for it.
That's right. And it's not just transient orcas. Since the Exxon Valdez oil spill, we've done research, intensive research in Prince William Sound, Kenai Fjords, and other parts of Alaska, and through developing technology have been able to fine-tune what we know about the complexity of killer whale societies in our waters. And so the whales that are the subject of my book, transient orcas in the Gulf of Alaska, we just did a population modeling paper. We expected we'd find that they might be in decline, the general transient population, but it turns out that they seem to be holding steady. But this particular group, the AT1s or the Chugach transients, as we now call them, they are very much tied to Prince William Sound. Their name is the transient moniker is kind of a misnomer for them in particular because they're not transient. They seem to center their range in Prince William Sound and Kenai Fjords and adjacent waters, a very small range, and they were around during the Exxon Valdez oil spill. They were in the sound and, in fact, were photographed by the spewing tanker within days of the grounding. And so this particular population of transients is on the brink of extinction.
Give me the numbers. How many are left? How many were there? How many are there now?
Okay.
Oh, well, there's only a few now, right?
Right. There were 22 at the start of the study, which is very small, granted. And yet they had an unusually high genetic diversity, which indicates that they probably were in a population bottleneck of some kind. They'd had at some point in the past they'd had some kind of a shrinkage of their population, but they were still producing calves at the beginning of the study. So their genetic diversity was enough to have them maintain themselves, and they were really the most commonly seen group, other than this one particular resident pod, AB pod, that was also impacted by the spill. So whenever Craig, in the early years, whenever Craig was not seeing residents, he'd run into the AT1s, this small population. They were quite vital and vibrant, as I describe in the book. When I first started my study, I saw them on a regular basis. And so 22 to start with, we lost 9 animals after the Exxon Valdez, and that took out some reproductive females, some males, which are adult males. You often think of reproduction as being sort of driven by these reproductive females, but turns out with killer whales, these large mature males are the only ones that reproduce successfully. So we lost some of them, and that was just too much for the group to overcome. They haven't had a calf since, and now we're down to 7 animals as of last summer.
I suppose we can't even talk about this without loading the language somewhat. I mean, I called it a population. You followed calling it a population, but some would argue, well, listen, this is just one family, basically, isn't it?
Well, it's not just one family. It's too genetically diverse. You could think of it as an extended family. With resident killer whale societies, they're definitely extended families. They're pods. The population is broken up into all of these pods that have a distinct dialect, and they all travel together for life, and they're related through the females. They're groups of related matrilines that travel together most of the time. With transients, they travel in matrilines, but and let's say the adjacent Gulf of Alaska transient population, they'll travel generally in a matriline, but you might see animals moving in and out of those matrilines, and they're an extended family, but they're not as closely related to each other as in a resident pod, let's say.
Yeah, well, I don't want to get into so much of a scientific thing, because that's not really what you're dealing with, I don't think, in this book. Into great silence. It's kind of almost a personal meditation, and it seems that what you're trying throughout the entire book to really come to terms with the dimensions of what's being lost.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And it took me, 20 years to feel that I could write this book, and the oil spill was incredibly traumatic for all of us, and I spent that whole summer, 4 months in the Sound during the oil spill. And
so you had just basically started on your research, right?
Yeah,
like a year or two before.
Right. My first summer of my first volunteering in the Sound was 2 years before the oil spill, and then my first summer on my own living at the whale camp out in southwestern Sound and collecting, trying to developed this study on the Chugach transients was in 1988. So really at the start of my master's project, the oil spill happened. And so it was sort of like having a split personality kind of dealing with damage assessment, because we were contracted with National Marine Fisheries Service to do the damage assessment on killer whales. But at the same time, to be following these and trying to do this observational and behavioral and acoustic study of this small group of whales at the same time as they're swimming through this gauntlet of boats. I mean, just the onslaught of boats from the cleanup, and so it was a challenging way to begin a study and to get to know a group of whales, and then to lose 9 of them after the first winter, that next winter after the oil spill,
and then keep losing them.
Through the years after the oil spill, I never could read a book about the oil spill. It just was too painful. And then I was presenting at a writing conference in Homer at the Kachemak Bay Writing Conference, and a literary agent heard me talk about the Chugach transients, and he said, "You've got to write this book. I want to help you write this book." And I had some resistance and to it anyway. And then I was diagnosed with breast cancer about a year later. And when I asked myself, well, if with breast cancer diagnosis, at the point when you get the diagnosis, you don't know what's going to happen to you, how it's going to turn out. And so I asked myself, well, what would I regret not having done if I didn't have that long on this earth? And it was, writing this book was just at the forefront. It was like that crucible moment where all the bull falls away, and I knew I just had to go forward and do it, and that's what I did in the years after my recovery from the treatment and everything.
Yeah, I mean, I sense that you're still in the straddle a little bit between viewing them as a scientist and viewing them as a poet and a companion, really, for your professional and spiritual life.
Yeah, and even I felt like that straddle was even more evident to me when I was engaged and actively doing my study and collecting data. And in the years since, as they've decreased to these small numbers, we've really backed off we've tried to give them space and tried to be respectful of just letting them be, even, you know, while we have to do our work, we have to take the photo ID pictures every year when we encounter them, and we've even tried to tag them, but for the most part we try to stay backed off, try to give them space, leave them alone, not dog them, follow them, pursue them, and we encourage the tour boats and other boats to do the same. So so in a way, I feel like I've not so much straddling anymore as have moved into a different place with my relationship to them because of that.
When you were laid up with your breast cancer treatment, you're on the East Coast and you're not in Prince William Sound, and Craig goes and tags one of them so you can watch it. Did he do it so you could watch it?
Well, I can't say. That would be a very romantic idea, wouldn't it, Steve? But
I always try and go for the blood here.
Yeah, right. Well, no, he was. It's we have tried to tag them because we are part of our work is especially with we're funded by the greatly by the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council, and who have provided funding for long-term monitoring, and part of that long-term monitoring is trying to detail more of the habitats of individual pods, and so it's part of our, you know, what we're supposed to do is our work. So, but the AT1, the Chugach transients do not let you tag them or get near them. They're very cagey, and so anytime we've tried, it's been clear that it's a complete waste of time. And this one, in this particular instance, when I was laid up, and Craig and his and our colleague Cy St. Amand were out there. Cy was taking my place. This animal named Chiniga, one of the last matriarchs of the population, kind of followed the boat after a day of trying to tag her, and showed up right next to the bow of the boat. And Craig said, "Well, this is it. It must be that it." He wouldn't admit to being quite so woo-woo about it, but it felt like she was basically saying, "Okay, if you're going to do it now." He did, and because of that, I was able to follow her movements while I was in Cape Cod, which was a strange and remarkable experience.
Well, I think we both agree there's huge advantage to tagging data if you can get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's turn to the tissue samples because I think in fairness, journalistically, we almost have to. You write about technology being developed where you can actually get a sample of some skin, some blubber, and then analyze it. And sometimes they didn't seem to notice they were being darted, and other times it seems, well, not darted, that dart would be a drug. This is just a simple little plug that's pulled out.
Mm-hmm.
Other times maybe because it went in at an angle or whatever, they would notice it, but sometimes they didn't seem to notice it. But for you and the way you write about it, there's a great squeamishness in you about the whole procedure.
Absolutely, yeah. I struggle with it to this day, and I have to really talk myself into participating in it in some ways, mainly because when you tag or dart a killer whale, you have to get much closer than you do for photo ID, and the thing that the saving grace is that the animals, the killer whales are the kind of animal that. If they don't want you near them, you can't get near them. They won't let you. And in fact, they seem to know exactly what you're trying to do. They seem to be able to detect. They know we approach them always exactly the same way to get photo ID pictures and have for all these years, like three decades basically. So these are long-lived animals, and they know our boat, and they know what we're doing, and they know when we're doing something that isn't quite what the usual is.
38% of our listeners at this point are saying this woman has gone off the deep end.
What?
I'll bet you, 38%. Building towards 50.
Why?
Well, because they don't want to think that there is an animal that would have that type of perception.
Well, they need to. We should film some of these encounters in which we're following. I'll just describe one particular encounter. We're following a male who we want to dart because it's an unusual pod, and so we're trying to look at the genetic relationships and the contaminant levels of all of these different and animals that we haven't darted. We particularly need to get. So this animal, it's a beautiful calm day, and this male is paralleling the boat. Craig is up on the bow with the biopsy gun, and I'm driving from above, so I have a great view into the water, and I can watch what the whale is doing. And it's paralleling the boat exactly as it's down for a dive, underneath the boat, just gliding along parallel with the boat. As soon as it's about to surface, it pumps its fluke a little harder, so it's just out of Craig's range. And then it does it over and over again. Other times it'll come up. It looks like it's going to be in perfect position, tips over to the left, and the fin so that there's no target anymore for the tag, and over again. And basically, we have to laugh and say, you know what? This isn't happening right now. And so much of the time, it feels like the animal decides when you're going to get that close, when you're going to do what you're going to do. So
well, now that you say it that way, predators need to be observant, and predators have a tendency to play because obviously not everything is going to be killing. You're not going to succeed at most of your killing anyway.
Right.
So there's actual selective advantage, I'm saying, in this sort of perception for many, many generations.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And they're incredibly perceptive of what's going on with other whales in their group. They're very tactile, and so their awareness of anything that's moving in the water near them, or it's astounding. They all actually react most to they don't react as much to being darted, let's say with a biopsy dart that goes into their saddle patch and pops out. Usually there's very little reaction, but if Craig misses and the dart hits the water next to them, they react tremendously. The entire group will react to that. I don't know if it's because of some kind of memory of having been shot at or what it is, but that something hitting the water near them in that way completely startles them. So, their awareness of what's going on, their ability to control their own, how close people can get. We're so much of the time we feel like we're not the ones in control of those encounters. And that's what makes it actually, that's what makes it easier for me to drive the boat and do the work that needs to be done is just having faith that those animals are going to let us know when we can do our work and when they've had it with us. They can easily get away from us, and I've had to make peace with it. And the reason, you know, that I've made peace with it also is because of the data that has come out of those, that work has been so essential for protecting their habitat and for understanding how they use their habitat and how important particular areas off the Copper River, for instance, off the Copper River Delta, unbelievably important areas for feeding for resident, particular resident killer whale pods, including a bee pod that was so severely damaged after the oil spill. So it, you know, the data that's come out of it, I do believe has been worth the harassment that we've had to put the whales through.
You get basically from the actual sample, then you get a, you can figure out what it's been eating, right? And you can also analyze for contaminants.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happened with the transients, the news was pretty bad, I understand. And it wasn't necessarily all from the oil spill either.
No, in fact, the kind of analysis that we can do is not, we can't detect hydrocarbons. That the analysis that we do, hydrocarbon analysis is a whole other ball game, and that was not done after the oil spill. What the kind of analysis that we're doing has to do with PCBs, DDTs, and flame retardants, those kinds of substances, that toxins that accumulate through the food chain, and they end up building up in the whale's blubber. And so those are that's the analysis that we've done. And killer whales, transient killer whales, which are the top of the marine food chain up here, are some of the most contaminated animals on Earth, and to the point where a carcass of a transient washed up on the beach could be considered like a, you know, like a toxic waste site. You know, it's got that high levels of toxins. So,
whoa.
Yeah.
Well, so I mean, if I were an attorney for Exxon right now, I would say, well, here you're finding all these contaminants that are not related to oil, and here you're seeing this population going down. What's to say that the oil spill is responsible for it?
Well, because we have Gulf.
I was just wondering, you know.
You can try to put on that Exxon lawyer hat. We had to definitely prepare ourselves for facing up to that possible scenario after the spill. And but anyway, well, killer whales seem to be able to reproduce. We have no way of knowing whether they're reproducing at levels in which they could reproduce in the past, but they are. The Gulf of Alaska transients are reproducing at a normal level, and they have those high contaminants. So that argument wouldn't wash.
Okay, so it's at least arguable that this population, that it was on maybe on the borderline already, but now it's lost its reproductive capacity.
Right,
and that's extinction.
Right, right, and it's a strange place to be with those animals because, yeah, you look at them and you know that we're going to lose them. They're going to disappear, and yet this when you're with those seven animals or any grouping of those seven animals out in the sound and you're watching them, they are so absolutely vitally alive and so doing exactly what they've always been doing. Some of the females are in their 50s, the two matriarchs, so they've been following those same coastlines, hunting those same waters, visiting those same seal haulouts, killing harbor porpoises in the same areas. They've been a part of that place for so long, and to them, to the observer and to someone who knows them, they're as alive as they've ever been, those particular animals. So I don't know, you could look at a lot of parallels. You could look at it as a parallel of a person, let's say, who has cancer. Do you look at that person as someone who's an epitome of death? Or do you look at that person as someone who's as vitally alive until they take their last breath? I mean, it's, so that's the conundrum in a way, the sort of that's the balance. That, to me, that's what I straddle when I think about the Chugach transients. I straddle that grief versus that willingness to stay present, fully present with the fact that they are alive and that they are fully alive, fully present with us right now. So that's the straddling that goes on, not so much the scientific versus the philosophical or spiritual. It's really, I think, completely on the spiritual level at this point.
Very well put. How about some phone calls?
Sure.
All right. Let's go to Doug in Talkeetna. Doug, you're on Talk of Alaska with Eva Salitas.
Hi. How you doing? Good morning.
Good morning.
Great show and a really, fascinating topic. My initial call was sort of in response to Eva describing working with these animals, just the process of the data collection. I was fortunate enough the last two winters to work down in Antarctica with John Durbin and Bob Pittman, and they're two killer whale biologists that work for NOAA, and seeing these animals firsthand up close and working with the people that know them so well and are trying to learn, more and more about them is really, a fascinating process. And the ability to get close to these animals, close enough to get a sample of tissue or to put on a tracking tag, may seem invasive, but to get management practices and say the transients in Prince William Sound that are now at a crux point where they haven't produced a viable offspring, and since the oil spill, management for these animals that live in these smaller populations but are distinctively genetically unique is crucial to find out what's going on with these guys. And it must be sort of heartbreaking to have sort of witnessed the decline of this very unique population of animals. And I'm just really enjoying hearing your perspective on all this.
Well, thank you so much for that. And you're so lucky to have been able to work with those two biologists, Bob and John, in Antarctica. That and actually the work that they've done with biopsy sampling has revealed an incredibly complex scenario down in those waters. There are several different subtypes of very distinct orcas in Antarctic waters, and it's like a viewpoint of just how complex it gets and how we can't manage them as a species or look at them as one thing, as one species. It's kind of, Bob Pittman is actually one of the people the biologist that's advocating for and breaking them up into multiple species.
Speciation of these animals. It would be, from what I've learned from them and from what I've seen, and I've witnessed, three different types of these killer whales. They don't even call them orcas anymore because that's the species name of the North Atlantic type specimen that even our Alaskan killer whales are likely to be split off into at least subspecies, I would think. But it's really an incredible. Those guys, they're the top predator in the ocean, and those guys, and you as well, I'm sure, just have a connection with them scientifically and philosophically and spiritually. It's hard not to. That has provided so much insight for the lay people and also the scientific community. It's really great.
I'm looking at a depiction of a Tsimshian house front here that is called a sea monster. Not a killer whale, a sea monster. It's quite a compelling piece of artwork here. But I think the whole, when they came up with these concepts of species, they had absolutely no idea that it would get down to populations. And now we're even into something different than that when it comes to the orca. We're into something different. Thanks a lot for that call, Doug.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Great show. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and Eva, I think this is the point before we take the break that I want to ask you about. You and Craig have been working out in the Falls Pass area, mm-hmm. and you found that you found a haploid, right?
Or haplotype, yeah.
Haplotype. Tell me about this.
Well, in False Pass is one of Unimak Island and False Pass. Unimak Island, I believe, should be a World Heritage Site. It's an absolutely astounding place ecologically, and there's a shallow shelf there, and as anyone who fishes there knows, and there's the migration of the gray whales happens through those across that shallow shelf. Some of them move up through False Pass into the Bering Sea, and some of them go through Unimak Pass, which is one of the most biologically rich areas in the world. And the orcas, the killer whales, know about this, and probably have known about it for centuries, and if not more time. But they have a gathering. We see the largest gatherings of orcas that we've ever seen in one place, congregating there and hunting the gray whales, mainly the calves and juveniles, as they pass through and during the migration. And it's shallow, so they can kill a gray whale calf or a juvenile, and then the carcass sinks, and they can feed on that carcass for days and days and days, and various groups will come in. And what's unusual is that, in general, different populations of transients don't mix with each other at all. But in that scenario, we've done the genetics, and we'll have Gulf of Alaska there's two different Gulf of Alaska haplotypes, these genetic types. And then there's several different haplotypes distinct haplotypes that are mixing there for this feeding bonanza, this almost like a potlatch. And one of them we found had the AT1 haplotype, which is the same genetic haplotype as the Chuyach transients. That doesn't say that, that's all that says is that at some point in the distant past, probably before the retreat of the ice, of the last ice age, that they were probably connected to our AT1s. And in a funny way, it's reassuring to know that some of those animals are, you know, that are distantly related, we're talking geologic time, are out there in the Bering Sea, and we know very little about them, almost nothing about them.
Research money is always hard to come by.
Yes, it is.
As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage of state government since 1991. On the web at akbudgetreport.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by ConocoPhillips, the easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The subject is extinction. Our guest is Eva Salidis, author of Into Great Silence, Leaving Resurrection, and Many Ways to Say It. She's in the studio with us, normally lives in Homer, goes out still on research trips with Craig Mackin to investigate the mysteries of the orca whale, which are many. You describe it as... It's all under the surface someplace. You just get little bits of it here and there. Some of it's, as you've explained, stuff that they will let you find out.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just little... This is the kind of game where you can spend days, even weeks, and see nothing.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the record for the amount of time that of not finding them was 13 days solid without seeing a killer whale, and searching as far as my little boat could take me to look, and listening with the hydrophone. And so field work with these animals requires a huge amount of patience and qualities that people don't think about when they think about becoming a biologist, or what makes a person a successful field biologist. And that, you know, some of those qualities are the capacity to be bored, and to be creatively bored, to just love a place and being in a place so much that, you know, that the time that you're not with the whales is time that you're still happy to be where you are.
I think it's handy to have a tree to hug.
Yeah, yep. It's handy to have a tree to hug, islands to hike on, water to jump into. But yeah, it requires a huge amount of patience. And part of the idea of integrate silence, or the title, has many different layers. But one of them is that we would have these, it seemed like the way that the Chugach transients would arrive, they'd come into an area. And this makes sense for mammal hunters. They'd come into an area and they'd hunt there for a few days. And by the end of that few days, you can imagine that those marine mammals are going to start to get a little wary of their presence and start not being complacent anymore. And so it makes sense for them to move on to another hunting area for a period of time. And so they'd come in and then they'd just disappear. They'd fill up the passage with calls or with their activity or with killing things. And then they'd completely vanish and we couldn't find them to save our lives. And so and that's still the way it is to a great degree. We still spend hours and hours and most of the time searching. And when it averages out, we have encounters about 50% of the days that we're out.
There's a sense of the mystery that is on the other side of the glassy surface of this water here that, you know, is very important, I think, to the book. And I'm wondering, how do you keep from projecting on those mysteries down there?
That's a great question.
Well, let me say this about, like, Craig. One thing that really, Craig Mackin, your partner, is like a force of nature in research. And one thing that he is he's one of these no BS people. And one thing that he is extremely good about is he's extremely dedicated, has all this integrity, and he's always guessing. He's always guessing. But somehow this doesn't bias the research. I never get the feeling that, you know, oh, he's got to prove this, and he's going against the facts, or he's trying to data snoop. I never get that from him. And, you know, so there you are working with him. And I know that he does. He speculates all the time about what's going on under there.
Sure. And that's actually, if someone had dropped a hydrophone or just a microphone down into the cabin of a research boat, I think they'd be surprised at what they would hear in the conversations that happen. And that a lot of times there's not only a lot of speculation, because that's how science works. That's how people think. That's how people come up with ideas, and then and creative ideas. It really is. I mean, there was an incredible biologist who really we consider as kind of one of the forefather of killer whale research in the Pacific Northwest and anywhere around the world. His name was Mike Bigg, Dr. Mike Bigg, and he had all of these. He was like considered the guru, you know, and Craig went down to meet him and get his blessing kind of to start the study in Prince William Sound. And all of these grad students, I just have this image of him sitting with, you know, grad students literally at his feet. And one of the things that these different grad students that my colleagues that I've talked to said that they would spend hours into the night speculating and throwing around ideas and philosophizing and doing all of those creative things but then when the job of science is, then you go out and you collect data and you ask questions and then you see what happens when you test those wild theories against what's really happening. But I think it's, you know, people think of creativity and science as being two different realms, but I actually think there's a tremendous amount of creativity involved. And when you meet a scientist who's a brilliant scientist, that's a highly creative individual who asks a lot of questions and speculates a lot. It doesn't mean they think of that as a fact, but they don't censor themselves from doing that kind of thinking and speculating just out there when you're with the animals. And I think it's a positive.
Well, Eugene by email says, the way the author describes the whales makes sense. I believe the whales are very intelligent, and I don't think she's just anthropomorphizing them. There you go. And I think maybe that's even part of the point, is that you need to have enough respect to say, well, no, it's not like me. It's something beyond me.
Right. Exactly. And how I think it's, there's a couple things I've thought a lot about anthropomorphizing and that idea. And it bothers me in some ways, because in some ways there's blatant anthropomorphizing when you think, oh, look, you project an emotion onto an animal. You're looking at 5% of what it's doing, and you're ascribing something to, you know, some kind of emotion, just as if you could do that with another person. But there's also, we make this assumption that somehow we're not animals ourselves, and that we don't have, that we couldn't somehow share things with the animals that we're watching on some deep level, because we are biology as well. And so so I think sometimes it's arrogant to also assume that we are different, that we aren't, that we wouldn't have commonalities with highly intelligent social animals. It doesn't mean that you just make assumptions about them, but to set yourself so apart that you think there couldn't be commonalities is really short-sighted. So, but the bottom line is they exist, especially whales. You know, we whales and dolphins, porpoises are, because they're highly intelligent, we know they have large brains, they're so highly social, it's natural for people to want to connect with them and feel and make those sort of emotional leaps to try to have an affinity for them. And yet we have to respect the fact that they live in a realm, they've evolved in a realm that is different from our air-breathing, two-leg walking realm with hand, you know, we have hands with opposable thumbs, and we have we rely on our eyesight so much to do what we're doing, and we're talking about an animal that exists almost like on another planet, you know, from ours. So they've evolved. They have these giant brains and this intelligence, and yet I don't think we can. It's hard for us to grasp the nature of that intelligence, because it's an intelligence that is evolved to encompass a completely other world. And so I love that about research. I love the fact, I love everything we don't know. I love how much we don't know. That's, and to me, the cover of the book in a way kind of exemplifies that, because that darkness, the ocean, really symbolizes the vast amount of things that we don't know and can't know.
You're making my mind go a million directions at once, Eva Salidis.
Good.
I better go to the phones. Jason in Copper Valley, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hey, thank you very much for taking the call on this.
Yeah.
And I'd like to hear where, I enjoy where the conversation is going. I guess I spoke, what first got my ire was Steve's comment towards 130 audience not understanding the animals, and I guess that would probably be the one third of your audience being Alaskans that haven't lived around dogs or cats or horses or any sort of livestock, haven't managed sled dogs, because as soon as you start cooperatively working with these other animals, that we're animals and they're animals, you will see all of the love that we would exhibit between ourselves, exhibited between the species, sometimes even interspecially, you know, a dog protecting a cat from another dog, et cetera. And so there's a lot where I think some of these conversations and considerations need to be put in perspective, that they are not dumb animals. They are animals. We are animals. We have, and they have been around for thousands of years. Here's an example in the whales. I'm not sure if the orcas are this case, but we have a species that literally changes their language every couple years. We can't do that. We don't do that. You know, that's a pretty amazing leap. And so when you're looking out here and looking at the structures, and it's, if you were a small tribe of Eskimos and you came into a rich grounds and the other tribes came and hunted you and ate you and chased you down, you'd go run away. And I think the orca whale is just as sensible as doing the same thing. And so I think a lot of these conversations, you know, beg the question of how we treat other animals' intelligence and their how we treat them as beings. If we are human beings, we must treat them as beings. If we are man, then we're an animal, and we'll treat them as animals, and they can treat us like animals. So this one leads to one of those questions that's got to me a lot. When you see the mass beachings of the marine mammals, if you're a peaceful tribe and you could not react with swords or guns, and your air, your water, your environment was being poisoned, it was loud and people were hunting you, wouldn't you do what Gandhi did and go and give your life to try to get the other beings' attention? So it's an interesting question. I'd like to hear your thoughts and get off the line on that one.
All right. Eva, strandings, beachings, and so forth. What's going on with that? Jason is speculating that perhaps there's just something unbearable in the water, so they want to go someplace away from it.
Well, there's some evidence for that, very specific evidence, and a biologist down in Puget Sound, Ken Balcom, he was one of the kind of forefathers or the first orca biologists other than native peoples. But he's found that, you know, with a mass stranding of dolphins in the Caribbean, when he did necropsies of these animals, he found that their ear bones were shattered. And so, and there had been testing of sonar in those waters, his conclusion was that these animals had been they'd had their ear bones shattered, which is a traumatic event, but that was the reason for that mass stranding, and we see that these proposals for that that kind of thing more and more.
Yeah, now I believe that's a military one, but there's also concern about seismic.
Yes,
and I know with Alaska seismic that there was a great concern to the Inupiaq. And that the accommodations were reached essentially to avoidance and on like that distances to try and keep the impact from the seismic from happening. But yeah, in that case, we're dealing with actual physical damage.
Right. Actual. But I think that also there's the possibility for if there's. I think noise in the oceans is a huge issue, a huge problem for marine mammals, and in the Arctic where there hasn't been that kind of shipping, that kind of traffic, I think that the concern is very real as to what that impact is going to be.
Your concern developing after the spill, you've just been a researcher for a couple of years, and you're already wondering about all the engine noise and everything, and what that's doing to these transients and their ways.
Right. Well, you can't
help. And they still have fidelity to places like Herring Bay, places that were hugely contaminated.
Absolutely. And absolutely. That was one of the astounding things.
Whoa.
And one of the astounding things about that summer, that 1989 and also 1990, when there was still tremendous amount of cleanup activity in southern, Night Island Passage, Montague Strait, and those areas, which are kind of the center of AT1 Chugach transient hunting habitat, is that they continued to come to those same areas, and there's this sense that they've evolved to their whole lives. This has been their hunting area, and this is where they go to hunt seals, and they have no concept of they've not evolved to understand an oil spill, the sudden presence of a huge amount of oil and a huge amount of boat traffic. And I mean, there's no way of making sense of that, and so they continued to go to these areas, and we think that was part of why we lost so many of them, because they were eating oiled harbor seals during that year. But when you work with acoustics, when you do an acoustic study of any kind of animal, and you're dropping a hydrophone in the water, and another realm of experience opens up to you. And you realize that what may look on the surface, is an idyllic scene with a few boats cruising by and some orcas, traveling along. You drop that hydrophone down and you hear the noise of a high-speed outboard. You can't help then but putting yourself in the place of those animals and thinking about what it's like for an animal that relies on listening to find its prey and what the impact of a high-speed outboard is close to that whale, it's got to have an impact.
We have to take a break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922, on the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC, and by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska, pebblepartnership.com. And by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com.
Well, we only got a few minutes left here, maybe about 7 minutes, but I do want to bring up that our show with Bill Strever has been made into a TV show and coming up on Thursday on Anchorage Public Television. And also that Dan Fauske, who's the guy in charge of the bullet line, is going to be our guest towards the end of April. Our guest today is Eva Salidis, and we've been talking about extinction and her book, Into Great Silence, a Memoir of Discovery and Loss Among Vanishing Orcas. Vanishing. There are distinct behavioral differences about this particular population. They sing a little different and act a little different than any other ones.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, and in particular, their dialect, their call repertoire is completely different. There's nothing else like it anywhere in the world. It's if you can imagine, it's literally like another language. They don't share any calls with Gulf of Alaska transients, which are a population that they encounter, that swims occasionally through the same waters. They always swim through the same waters as residents and share no calls with residents. They're completely unique acoustically, and their acoustics are remarkable and fascinating and beautiful to listen to and haunting.
I guess you should have brought some. It's radio, darn it.
Yeah, I could have brought some. I actually have them on my computer, right? My computer's in my backpack sitting right next to me, and I could probably pull them up if there was a caller or something like that while I was distracted, I could pull them up. But they are unique, and they also are unique in that they use such a small area, while a normal transient population it'll range over thousands of miles. The West Coast transients range from southeastern Alaska, northern southeastern Alaska, all the way down towards Southern California. And so the Chugach transients are unique in how much fidelity they have to place.
But you did find them going across to
Kenai Fjords.
Yeah, Ayalik Bay and
right.
over in there.
But if you look at a nautical chart,
the same thing, really.
You see that there's a reason why they call this belying sound,
yeah.
right? They called it a sound because you look at that the way that the geography is with Kayak Island on one side and the Pie Islands on the other side, and you realize for a whale, for us, it seems a formidable passage to make that crossing. For a whale, that's home. That's just normal.
Okay, let's go down to Fairbanks. And Johnny, welcome to Talk of Alaska. Johnny?
Hi. I got a chance to meet Eva in probably 1987. She was camped out on South End of Night Island. And I was a...
Yeah, that was her.
Go ahead.
I said that was her.
Yeah, and anyway, camped out pretty amazing. Rugged, definitely... doing it. But anyway, I was a commercial fisherman down there, and I guess I wanted to, I heard there was a lot of sad things coming out of the probable extinction and stuff, and I just wanted to provide, a glimmer of hope. It's great that Eva's out there helping change attitudes and actions. It's pretty amazing. I was definitely part of a group of really rogue fishermen down there doing some really bad things and with the whales or against the whales. They were taking our fish. I can look back on it, you know, so many years back, and it's just I can't even believe what we were doing. But thanks and kudos to Eva and people like her for doing some great things.
Well, I thank you so much for calling. And I remember so many, not necessarily names, but so many people who are out there that we realized what was going on, and we realized what an incredibly complicated situation it was, what a difficult situation it was for fishermen during that time. That was more in the mid 80s with the longline interactions, which are also happening again now. But I relied on for my life and for my safety on knowing those other people were out there, and they were they provided such a sense of security for me and often incredible aid and I feel like just being out there in the Sound, no matter what we were doing or what we were what our motivations or intentions were, I felt like there's a community of people that was changed forever by that place and by encounters with those animals, and I really appreciate your call.
It was nice talking to you again.
All right, Johnny. Thanks for your call. Took some guts to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was a serious situation. And it was resident. It was fish eating killer whales, a particular pod, the same pod that was impacted by the oil. That
and they'd figured out how the sound of the winches.
And they figured they could outsmart any kind of trick that anyone tried, other than moving long distances. It's a intractable problem to this day, other than switching to pot fishing, which is a whole other issue that Craig could talk on and on about. But the Chugach transients were not involved in that interaction. They were not going after fish.
Well, gosh, you know, we got less than a minute left. Got anything left to say?
Yeah, I did want to say one last thing that came up when, and I think Johnny's comment and another one is that value of long-term research and you know, when we talk about these ineffable questions on not understanding, you know, not knowing what the whale's behaviors mean or all that idea of anthropomorphism and how it takes, especially with marine mammals, it takes a lifetime to really learn anything about them. It takes a commitment and so. You can't get instant results with that kind of research. You have to commit to the long term, and we've had that kind of support, and we're incredibly grateful.
Yeah, I think mastery takes a while.
It does.
And it keeps growing.
Yeah, you never get there.
Just when you think you've got it, you find out, oh, no, I didn't get it.
That's right.
Thanks so much for being with us.
I really appreciate being here.
All right, next week it's Alaska Natives and science. Thanks very much to Josh Edge and Dave Waldron. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. The University of Alaska Anchorage, the ultimate cross-trainer for finding your place in the world, home to stellar academic programs and an exciting campus energy with all of the thrills you'll only find outside of an office or classroom. The University of Alaska Anchorage, amazing stories being written every day. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.